from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, San Francisco native and travel writer Francis Tapon has traveled every Eastern European country from the Gulf of Finland to the Black Sea, and he provides us with a wide-ranging personal and historical travelogue through 25 countries of the former Eastern Bloc. He'll join us in studio for the hour, and we'll discuss his newest book with him. It's called The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. San Francisco native Francis Tapon, son of a French father and a Chilean mother, has traveled to over 80 countries, hiked over 12,500 miles. He's covered the USA four times on foot, hiked the Appalachian and Pacific Crest trails, and walked a round trip on the Continental Divide Trail. A graduate of Amherst and a Harvard MBA, and by the way, a product also of the French American School in San Francisco, he left the tech world in 2006 after co-founding a robot vision company in Silicon Valley and consulting for Hitachi and Microsoft, with the ambition of visiting every country in the world. And for 3 years, he traveled in Eastern Europe. And the result is one of the world's most personal, idiosyncratic, and unorthodox cultural and historical travel guides. The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us, takes us from Poland, Serbia, Bulgaria, Lithuania, and the Czech Republic to Romania, Slovenia, Albania, and Croatia, into the Ukraine, Latvia, Hungary, and Macedonia. And Francis Tapon joins us in studio for this morning's second Forum Hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
We've never met, but you told me before we went on air, you've been listening to me for years, and here you've got the voice and the face together, and I've got the face of someone who became very real to me in this book, taking us into all kinds of personal, intimate sorts of things, and taking us also on an extraordinary journey. You say you're not a historian, although there's a lot of history in your book. You're an explorer. That's how you think of yourself.
That's right. Yeah, I think that I'm not so much interested. Of course, I'm interested in finding out the truth as much as I can, and so I do a lot of research, and I do share some of that research in the book. But what I'm trying to do most of all in the book is to try to also understand what is in people's heads. There's a saying that victors write history, but I'm not so sure how true that is in some ways, because victors may write the history, but the losers may not read it. And so I wanted to know, what is it that parents tell their children and about what really their history is like? And so I tried as much as possible to get involved in these cultures and talk to as many of the people, stay with them, live with them, and to find out what their perspectives were about their own country, their neighbors, et cetera.
Yeah, you do get a lot of that sense of who they are, what they are, and how they see themselves and how they see the world around them. We begin this book in an outhouse, actually, in Finland, with you up by the Arctic Circle, with you trying to kick the door in or kick your way out. But you move around and take us into so many different places. I mean, it's really an impressive and ambitious book. But this whole notion of what Eastern Europe is and how we define the geography of Eastern Europe has been sort of a conundrum. In fact, at one point you say in the book, only Moldovans are happy with the Eastern European label. And then at another point you say, well, it's the Moldovans and maybe a few other places. Croatia and all others call themselves Central Europe, but in Turkey and Belarus and Ukraine, they're okay with Eastern Europe.
Yes, that's true. You're right. And if you go way out east, although I'm not so sure Russians, because they have 80% of their country, roughly 75% of their country is in Asia, they're kind of in a class by themselves. But you're right. The Belarusians, the Ukrainians, and probably even the Romanians are okay with the label. And, of course, the Moldovans.
But many people would say, come on, you got Turkey in here. You've got Greece in here. That's not Eastern Europe. But,
of course,
it is really Eastern Europe.
Yeah, and Finland as well, which is also kind of a controversial – because what it is, Michael, is that they're confusing connotation with geography. And I'm trying to look at just a simple binary east-west split. And there's no Northern Europe, no Central Europe, no Southern Europe, no Southeastern Europe, just simple East and West. Just like we divide the United States East and West by the Mississippi River, people in Montana may not like being called Western Americans because they might say, I'm Northern American. But that's just a geographic fact. And if you look at a map, Finland is just above the Baltic.
Well, I'm also struck early on in reading your book about your caveat about stereotypes, because you say, well, you know, be warned, there are going to be some stereotypes here. And you do have a lot of stereotypes. Give me some examples. Estonia is the freest country in the world and the least religious country on earth. The Albanians, although they're hated by other Balkanians, as you put it, and most of them live outside of Albania, are the friendliest people in the world. I mean, there are these kinds of superlatives. I think you have the authority maybe to say them, but people are struck by those superlatives, aren't they?
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit provocative in one way, but I think that at the same time, stereotypes is another word for generalizations and that we have. And people in Eastern Europe are tired of being thrown in as one bloc. They're tired of saying, this is the Eastern bloc, and we see them all as one. And that's how it was during the Cold War. We just saw the, you know, all those guys, the communists, on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And so they
now call New York and Washington the Eastern bloc. Boston, I'm
sorry. That's right. But basically, I think that in Eastern Europe, they want to have a little bit more granularity. For example, people in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, they want each of them to have their own identity. And what is an identity? In the end, it's a collection of stereotypes and generalizations about what those people are. Of course, it doesn't apply to everybody, but it's something that we characterize the people. Americans have a certain stereotype. It's not saying that everybody is like that, but there's a certain character to being American. And so there's a certain character to being French, certain character to being Bulgarian.
But are Finnish kids really the smartest kids?
Well, statistically, yes.
Yeah. So you do back this up with some data.
That's right. Yeah. As much as I can, I don't try to throw out, you know, random statements without some research behind it. And so when I say that, let's say, Eastern Europeans don't have a tendency to smile and laugh so much, when Gallup asked the world, did you smile and laugh a lot yesterday? Roughly 70% of Eastern Europeans, sorry, there was no country under 70% of Eastern Europeans who were saying, yes, I do smile and laugh a lot the previous day, versus Western Europeans, everybody's over 70% were saying, yes, I smiled and laughed a lot yesterday. And so there is some data, and this is self-reported data. In other words, the Eastern Europeans saying to themselves. And so, yes, it's a stereotype that they're a little bit, you know, dour and a little bit grumpy at times on the surface. And they're kind of saying to themselves, yes. Is it a stereotype? Yes. Is it a negative stereotype? Perhaps, yes. But there's some facts to back it up as well.
Well, talk about dour and grumpy. When I was in Prague, I felt that at least the people in Prague, not necessarily the Czech Republic, but the people in Prague were about the coldest people. And it may have been that Soviet freeze that had been there for so long, even though Prague, as you say, is probably the most beautiful Eastern European city. But the Czech drink more beer than anybody in the world, too, I learned from your book.
You would think that that would make them super happy. And in fact, Eastern Europeans are the biggest consumers of alcohol on a per capita basis than anywhere else. If you look at the United Nations, they measured the amount of pure alcohol consumed. So throughout the
– they got way over the Irish, too, even, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. And the top 10 nations in the world were all Eastern Europeans, the only exception being Andorra, which is a tiny little nation nestled between Spain and France. But Eastern Europeans do indeed consume a lot of alcohol, and that is a fact.
But here I'm thinking about how cold they were in Prague, and you found them in Bulgaria more welcoming and kind of from the collectivist attitude, the same sort of thing that seemed to me to impress me about the Czechs, that they had this kind of Soviet domination and collectivism that made them really very remote and cool. You found the welcoming in Bulgaria from sort of the same kind of collectivism.
That's a good point. I think that the collectivism had a benefit. In other words, that mentality is to look after your neighbors. And in Bulgaria, for example, Bulgarians, you know, invited me to their homes. They were very welcoming. I did some couch surfing there, which is basically strangers invite you to their homes. And in one case, a lady gave me her key to her apartment. She wasn't even there. She didn't even know me. She didn't even meet me. And she just said, here, stay at my apartment. And, you know, that's just – that's one of the benefits of collectivism, is that you can kind of try to help the common person.
We're talking, by the way, with Francis Tappan. His new book is The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. And there is, in fact, with each country he goes to, a kind of highlighting about things we can learn from our Eastern European friends or enemies. Hike Your Own Hike is also a book he wrote, Life Lessons from Backpacking Across America, which actually has a map in it that takes you through the Appalachian Trail and all of that. And Serbia, you call Europe's most misunderstood country, and compare it to Oklahoma, which, you know, on the face of it may throw some people, but let's talk about why it's so misunderstood. I mean, one of the things I was struck by was, you know, I was thinking, do Serbians resent us because we bombed the hell out of them, we being the United States? And you found none of that.
Yeah, not on a personal level. They resent the United States government for having done that and NATO from having done that. But what surprised me the most is when I went to Serbia, it's as if they were falling over each other to be welcoming to me, even though they knew I was an American. In fact, there was one point I was traveling with a German. So here we were, two NATO people who bombed them. And we went down to southern Serbia where it got the biggest, you know, some severe bombing. In fact, stayed at a house whose house was blown, the roof was blown off the house because a NATO bomb bombed a nearby bridge and the force of the blast blew off their whole roof and shattered all their windows. And yet they invited a German and an American to their homes to stay with them. And so, you know, to me, the hospitality of the Serbians was phenomenal. And again, I credit them for separating U.S. government policy with a U.S. citizen traveling in their country and being able to see the difference between that and being welcoming and friendly. To me as an American, who, of course, I don't decide U.S. policy.
You know, the old bad joke about there was so much bombing that they lost all their vowels. In fact, you you write about language a lot here. You write about I'll come back to Serbia in a moment, but say Hungary must be a Martian language.
Yes. Yeah. A Hungarian, as well as Albanian, for that matter, are these languages that seem to fall out of the sky. Because if you kind of study linguistics, even as an amateur, you kind of notice that languages evolve slightly and there's little differences between Italian and French and Spain.
Well, those are all Romance languages.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And so you can kind of see the evolution. And same thing with the Slavic tongues. You see a little different, you know, similarities between Slovenian and Croatian as well as Russian. You see the connections. But then all of a sudden there's Hungarian, completely out of this world. And it really you have no connection to anything. And same thing with Albanian, just like it seems like they dropped from the sky by a Martian.
So getting back to Serbia, though, for a moment, why people are probably wondering, why is it the most misunderstood country and how is it like Oklahoma?
Okay, let me clarify. I said specifically that it's Serbia, Kosovo is like Oklahoma more than I'll try to explain that. Basically, Oklahoma has some large tracts of land that are Indian reservations, and these are protected territories, autonomous, completely separate from the rest of the U.S. control. And so that's one of the things that kind of separate the Oklahoma territories with that of Serbia. And it's the same thing in Kosovo. In Kosovo, they have their own – they had their own – during the Yugoslav period, they had their own autonomous region. And that was what separated them. And so when Yugoslavia broke up, they faced a decision in Kosovo. They could either stay with Serbia or they could break away. And the same – if you can imagine the U.S. breaking up, what would happen to Oklahoma? You would have the Native American tribes that, you know, that territory might say, we want to be autonomous too. And we want to have we want to be independent as well. And we're not going to go with the country of Oklahoma. We're going to be separate from them. And so that's one of the things that happened, I think, with the breakup of Yugoslavia.
You spent a lot of time writing about that breakup and writing about Tito. And I guess the common wisdom often has it that Tito kept everything together and things were much better under Tito. And, you know, neighbors got along and intermarried, even though they were Croatian and Serbian and so forth. And yet underlying that was all this volcanic stuff that erupted, of course, after the breakup.
Yeah, that is the paradox, is that if you talk to people, they definitely were very happy with Tito for the most part, that people in Yugoslavia it was a prosperous period for them. And yet at the same time, it was all of a sudden erupted in so much animosity and anger. And so it made me wonder, like, was this kind of underneath the covers this whole time, even under Tito? Was it kind of just brewing there and it just exploded? And so that's kind of the only, you know, logical conclusion. It just didn't boil up out of nowhere. And that, to me, was a big tragedy of Yugoslavia, is the fact that they were so prosperous compared to the rest of Eastern Europe. They had if you look at kind of four versions of communism, on the one extreme, you have like Albanian communism, which was coldly closed in, from the whole world.
Under Hoxha.
Right. Enver Hoxha. And then he lasted for over 40 years and completely closed. He closed himself off from the USSR. He closed himself off from China. He closed himself off from the West. He was completely isolated.
They were like North Korea, basically.
Absolutely. And so then you have a third. So that's one flavor of communism on the one extreme. And then as you move down the spectrum, you run into the USSR version of communism, which was fairly totalitarian state, fairly controlled. Then the third, another level down the spectrum, you would have places like the goulash communism that you might have in Hungary, or, you know, communism with a human face that you might have in the Czech Republic. And then finally, on the other extreme, is Yugoslavia's version of communism, which was the most liberal and open. In 1967, Tito let the Yugoslavs travel freely. In fact, the Yugoslav passport was worth more than any other passport in the world. You could travel anywhere on the planet if you were a Yugoslav after 1967, which is quite different than, let's say, with the typical communist person in the rest of Eastern Europe. They couldn't go anywhere without permission and et cetera. And so that's the tragedy of Yugoslavia, is that they were so close to the West. And Tito also let certain amount of limited free enterprise and businesses and privatization limited. Again, much more so than the rest of Eastern Europe. And that's the big tragedy, is that they were so close. If you look at the chasm that they had to cross in order to become free and to become more like the West, it was a very short leap for Yugoslavia because they were already so close to us in so many ways. And yet they were the ones who devolved into all sorts of anarchy, and nearly 250,000 people died in the Yugoslav wars. And to me, that is the big tragedy. Whereas Albania and the USSR, they had to move much further in order to migrate to a more Western style democracy and market system. Yet they did it largely peacefully.
Talking again with Francis Tapon, who has written about Eastern Europe and speaking about Russia. I'm interested to get your take now on. Well, what's going on there? What's going on there seems to be mounting more and more protests against the Putin government, more corruption in the elections. I mean, there was all this certainly hope and elevated spirit, kind of a Russian spring, you know, attached to Gorbachev and Perestroika and all the changes that took place. And now it would appear as if there's a lot of anger and desire to go back to something democratic or go forward with democracy.
Yes and no. I mean, there is – okay. On the one hand, we've got to take a little perspective here. For example, you've got roughly in the latest protests that have been happening just recently, a few days ago in Russia, you're getting roughly around 50,000 protesters on the street, which sounds like a lot. But on the other hand, let's put that in perspective. In 20 years ago, when the USSR collapsed, they had 10 times more people, roughly 500,000 people on the streets. And it was the same time period, December, so it's cold outside. Second of all, you got to remember that Moscow is the biggest city, the most populous city in Europe. They've got like four different circles of traffic going around, encircling the city. They have the second biggest subway system in the world. They have like 82 stations and 13 lines. It's enormous. 10 million people in Moscow. And so when you have a population of 10 million plus, and then you have the surrounding area, it's not that hard to get 50,000 people to show up for a protest. It's not. So it's not the anger in Russia is there, and there's some frustration, but it's not like it was 20 years ago where they wanted a complete revolution. Right now, still, Putin is popular. He's got a 51% approval rating. Compare that to Obama, which is roughly around 44%, and George Bush, which hit a low of around 25%. So Putin is still one of the most popular leaders in the world. He used to be 69% earlier in 2001. And so he's actually fairly well supported by the Russians. But you're right. There is dissatisfaction, and that is manifesting itself on the street, and they do want change.
And a lot of it has to do not even with the corruption of the elections, but the ongoing struggle with the economy there, don't you think?
That's right. And the economy is suffering, and people have become cynical both of the market economy, and they've become cynical about democracy. If you ask people, you know, are they satisfied? Are they dissatisfied? With democracy, 81%. Of Ukrainians said that they were dissatisfied with democracy. 81% were dissatisfied with democracy. And you compare it, and they asked the Pew Research Center asked people, "Did you support the move to multi
party systems, multi-party elections. And nowadays, only about a third of Ukrainians and roughly half of Russians support the move. And that's a big change from 20 years ago. They were much more enthusiastic 20 years ago, roughly 70% or so who were kind of in favor of the move to multi-party elections.
There's been a lot of deflation of hope, though, from 20 years ago.
Absolutely.
I mean, you think about glasnost and perestroika.
Absolutely.
And again, like you said about Yugoslavia, it's sad. I'm opening a chapter of yours here on Bosnia and Herzegovina, going back to Yugoslavia for a moment. As complicated as its name is the title of the chapter, you say Bosnia and Herzegovina is Europe's most complicated country. That's ironic because it's filled with Europe's simplest people.
That's
and
right.
You mean that obviously complimentary.
Absolutely. And
simple meaning elemental and basic. And
yeah, and focusing on simple pleasures and being happy with little and focusing on the food and the cuisine and the music. I mean, the Bosnians are very simple, easygoing people, and that's what and they're wonderful. And yet their country is a nightmare to try to understand. It's so complicated to and I had to spend a lot of time in the area to try to finally figure out how this country works, and it barely works.
You also, trying to just touch upon some of the places that you went to and wrote about extensively, and dispelled a lot of myths about these places, too, at the same time that we said you were dealing with cultural stereotypes and all that. And you write about Romania, and years ago I was offered a Fulbright there. I turned it down because it was when Ceausescu was in power. And as you say, I mean, things have never really been the same post-Ceausescu. They've never really gotten away from that, have they?
Yeah,
well, as opposed, say, to Eastern Germany, where you know the Stasi is gone and there's been some liberation. Romania still has a cloud. Like, I mean, I was interested in you calling Bucharest kind of a poor man's Paris, which it really is. But there's still that sense of gloom in Romania, almost, isn't there?
Yeah, there's kind of frustration, nostalgia going on in Romania too. And the good news for Romania is that they did join the European Union, and I think that a lot of times, and same thing happened with Bulgaria. And same thing happened with the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. But what happens sometimes is that the EU is kind of like this nirvana state. And then all of a sudden, everything will become better once we get into the EU. And of course, they get into the EU and they're like, oh, crap, it's not that much better.
The Turks should take notice. But, you know, I mean, I think also you talk about Ceausescu as the vampire, you know, who sort of sucked all the blood out of the Romanians. And that's what I meant by that still gloom there. You know?
Yes, that is true. And the Romanians are very frustrated right now with their government. They're frustrated with the state of their economy. And it's unfortunate because Romania has so much to offer. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. And you look at their natural resources. You look at what they're blessed with as a country. Their people are educated. And so it's kind of frustrating for me to visit there. I'm like, why can't this country be much more powerful and strong and vigorous and healthy? And yet they kind of stuck in the mud still and trying to claw their way out of it. I'm still optimistic about Romania, but it's been an uphill battle for them.
We're coming up on a break, and I want to give out our phone number. And when we come back, we might hear from Francis Tappan about some hidden places to go see in Eastern Europe for the toughened travelers, as well as those of you who like your creature comforts. But in the meantime, many of you who have traveled this part of the world and may have some observations or stories of your own, or you have questions or comments, certainly you are welcome to join the conversation, and you can do that now, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and we welcome your calls and your involvement in the program. Again, toll-free, you can join us now at 866-733-6786 as we talk about Eastern Europe with Francis Tappan. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment, and of course, you can also go to our Facebook page and post questions or comments there. Francis Tappan's book is The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with San Francisco native Francis Tappan, who has written a book called The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. And we're going to go right to your calls here. Let's go to a couple of emails first. Venkat says, I want to know more about Francis's perspective on the war in the Balkans. We have all watched the Serbia-Croatia war. What is the situation today?
Well, right now, the hot spot that still exists in the Balkans right now is in Kosovo, especially in northern Kosovo. Yet things are dramatically cooled down. And I think that in general, things have cooled down everywhere in the Balkans. For those who are thinking about traveling in the Balkans, it's completely safe. In fact, I even went through Kosovo a couple of times. And in fact, it's very tame.
But I remember when you started in Kosovo, there was still war.
I mean, that's right. Yeah, when I first went in there, there had been some serious riots, you're right. But in general, things have calmed down, and even in Kosovo. But it is the one hotspot that's left, and there's a fighting between the Serbs but there's not like a all-out war by any means, just skirmishes at best.
Well, before we go to our caller, Steffi wants to know, if you were leaving the U.S., which Eastern European country would you live in and why? And would it be city or countryside? Well, in your book, you say Montenegro, you'd buy a house because obviously you love Montenegro. Is that
Me personally, yes. I adored Montenegro, especially the coast near Kotor. It's absolutely phenomenal. It's actually quite near Dubrovnik, which is another wonderful place to consider. I adore the Adriatic Sea, all the countries, Slovenia, Croatia, and Montenegro. They're great. Even Albania has some interesting spots. But those three, I would say, are great places to live. But it also depends on how sensitive you are to weather, because a lot of Eastern Europe does get some pretty brutal winters. And so for people who would think about moving to Eastern Europe, it depends on how you feel about getting snowed in on.
So we're going to hear from listeners and some of their Eastern European experiences and questions that they have for you. But just that question I put out before we went to the break, and that is, what would you particularly recommend for toughened travelers, places to go, and more for also those who, like I said, like their creature comforts?
Well, for a tough traveler, somebody who's used to dealing with discomfort in strange places and they don't speak English, then there's three places I would recommend that are really off the beaten path. One is Kosovo, the second one is Moldova, and the third one is Belarus. They are all three kind of unique in being – Belarus is still basically a communist country run by Alexander Lukashenko, and it's a very kind of controlled state operation. So that's fascinating in itself. You have a little bit of glimpses of how communism was 20 years ago. It's kind of – the remnants are still
there. Can you just give us that quick thing about washing dishes in Belarus?
Oh, yeah. There's a great invention I saw. It was in Belarus, but you did see it in other places in Eastern Europe. And it's just that in America, when you hand wash a dish, we kind of wash a dish and we put it into a dish rack, wait for it to dry, and then you put it into your cabinet. So it's kind of like this three-step process. You wash, put it in the dish rack, and then put it in your cabinet. In Belarus, they had a hole on the bottom of their cabinet. So basically, you wash the dish and you put it right into the cabinet directly onto a dish rack in the cabinet itself, saving yourself a step. And I just thought, wow, this is brilliant. This is great. And the water drips through the cabinet, lands onto the countertop, which is, of course, is waterproof. And it's just I thought, wow, what a great invention. Why don't we have that?
You do a lot for many of these countries in terms of things that they did invent or things that they contributed. I didn't know, for example, that Hungarians invented the ballpoint pen or the holograph. I mean, this is sort of making Americans aware of the contributions in many respects. Artificial blood came out of Hungary. But let me get back to the creature comfort traveler. Where would you?
The creature comfort traveler would definitely stay on the western parts of Eastern Europe. In other words, Czech Republic, Poland, probably Slovakia, and definitely Slovenia. Slovenia probably being the most civilized Western of all the countries, very safe, very pretty, very nice, and it's great. You know, I spent almost a year there, and so Slovenia for people who are creature comforts. Poland is great. Those are all wonderful countries.
And you know what Krasny means in Slavic?
No idea.
No.
Sorry, bad research.
It means beautiful.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Krasny. Krasny. But that's, I think of that as in Russian. Yeah,
in Russian, it's red. Yeah, like Krasnaya Plocha is red square, but it's like Russo in Italian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Let's go to some callers. And Colleen, you're first up here from Denver, Colorado. Good morning.
Good morning. Francis, I just want to tell you how much I enjoy your webpage so much. And I've learned so much from you about lightweight traveling and also traveling economically.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I do my best to share some of the lessons I learned from it. And I think that one of the
lessons is you got to be a monk. That's
that's true. But one of the benefits of traveling lightly and also economically is that you get closer to the people. and you're more likely to travel on buses and trains and meet people. You're more likely to stay at people's houses. And so that, to me, is the most enriching part of the travel experience. That's what I really kind of thrive in. And so that's one of the key side benefits versus staying in a hotel and kind of very separated from and taking taxis the whole way. You're kind of separated from the culture.
Well, you're a guy who doesn't watch much television either, so you don't need those kind of creature comforts.
No, I've never owned a television in my life.
And Colleen, thank you for your call. We go to Berkeley next. Nancy, hi, you're on.
Oh, hi. I was really excited when you started talking about this. In 1987, I took my 20-year-old daughter to Russia, Budapest, and Prague. And we just had a terrific time. We did it all on our own. And Russia especially, it seemed like it was the best time. I was very safe. We just wandered around at night. We went to the Moscow Circus and everything. And I have a feeling that it's not as wonderful as it was in 87. And also, as far as cities, Budapest is just the most fantastic place. I came home and I said to my husband, I said, when I retire, I'm taking the dog and moving to Budapest.
Yeah.
There's restaurants on every corner. The city is gorgeous. And, it was just a wonderful trip.
Yeah, I think that she makes a great point about the fact that one of the benefits of the communist society is that it was a police state. And that everybody could, you could be a single woman. I talked to people, Albanians. You could walk at 2 o'clock in the morning as a single woman in a miniskirt and nothing would happen to you. Nobody would bother you.
It's like that today in Cuba, because I was there, not too long ago.
And, yeah, exactly. And so that's one of the benefits of having this kind of heavy-handed and strict state. And so,
but that's true in Iran too, I think.
Perhaps. But I think that in the case of the nostalgia, explaining some of the nostalgia that a lot of Eastern Europeans have for the communist time is the fact that they did feel much safer than they do today. Criminality has increased. And so that's one of the frustrations that exists.
And you could take that not only out of the communist world. I remember when I was traveling in Spain, I would talk to all the cab drivers and they would all say the same thing. Under Franco, things were safer. Under Franco, things were better. There weren't all the narcotics and so forth. And that's on the right.
Sure.
Another caller from Denver, Colorado. Cindy, that's you. Welcome. You're on.
Oh, thank you so much. Francis, I cannot wait to get my book, Hidden Europe. I go to the mailbox every day looking for it. But I have talked to you on your Facebook page about my trip to Belarus. And what I wanted to add to your conversation, when you're talking about how some of the people in Eastern Europe are a little darker, maybe they are less friendly, at least to our American appearance, I saw a bit of a dichotomy between Americans and the Belarusians in that when you're in Belarus, they're not looking at you. You go to a place where you're buying something and they're not particularly friendly. Me, I'm an American. I'm not on vacation. I'm smiling at everybody. And people think I'm a bit of a freak, but the people we were visiting, the family, they were kind of telling me, kind of cool down on that, and people are thinking you're weird. But the beauty of the people that you did connect with on an eye-to-eye basis or a friend-to-friend basis, even if you were a total stranger, their love and passion for hospitality was something I really had never experienced in the U.S. And here I met these people for the first time, and they were very welcoming and a lot of toasting with vodka, not to get drunk, but to express genuine passion. That's the best thing I can say, passion in a loving and caring way. These toasts were tearful, like prayers, and telling you, we hope everybody in your family is well and prosperous and healthy in the coming year, and we look forward to meeting them someday. They might not.
Yeah, Cindy, I thank you for that call. And you found pretty much that kind of warmth and passion, as she called it, in Belarus.
Yeah, and that's the key thing is when we talk about, let's say, that kind of coldness or that grumpiness that's initial, it's mainly in the customer service environment. When you're going to either an airport and you talk to a customer service representative or buying train tickets or going even to a shop, that you may face. But on a one-on-one personal level, then they become much warmer. Maybe at the very, very beginning, they might be a little bit distant, but they quickly do.
You're talking about broadly across the plains of Eastern Europe here.
Yes, yeah. I'm making a huge sweeping statement. And while we're making sweeping statements, I would also say that people in the Balkans tend to be much more open and friendly, even off the bat. But she is talking about Belarus, and so I think that you do find that. And once you do get in, they're so thrilled to have, you know, a Westerner coming all the way to Belarus to see them. It's a special treat for them, and they are extremely hospitable.
You seem to have a following in Denver, Colorado, by the way. You notice the first two of the three callers. But here's a caller from San Francisco. Maria, hi. You're on.
Hi. I'm very glad I am on because I am a born Hungarian with an American feeling against what this young man is talking about. Because he's saying everything is so marvelous, so wonderful, the people are great and all that. But he doesn't see that underneath all that wonderful thing to a visitor, it doesn't show the hatred and the division in society that is extreme, and it's getting more and more like the Nazi times, especially in Hungary. They hate the Jews and the Gypsies just as much as they did then, and they are doing nasty things. So all these wonderful statements about how great those people are, I think, are extremely superficial.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And in Hungary, actually, I do talk about quite a bit of – in fact, throughout the whole book, I do talk about some of the negative issues.
You write a lot about Auschwitz with Poland.
Yeah, sure. But I'm talking about present-day dislike and frustration and racism. It's quite –
It's very strong in Hungary, yeah.
Yeah, certainly. But it's you do see it all over Eastern Europe. You do have that. And the caller is right. And in fact, in Hungary, what surprised me the most is just how – upset people were. In fact, 27% when Gallup asked people, were you depressed yesterday? 27% of Hungarians said yes, which was higher than any other nation in Europe. And so the Hungarians are very frustrated when they are asked about whether their economy was in good shape. Like over 95% said no, absolutely not. And if you ask people about how they feel about the situation in Hungary, Hungarians are extremely frustrated with their country. And she's absolutely right. And I definitely hit these points hard in the book as well. And so I don't want to paint the picture that this is some sort of fairy tale land in Eastern Europe. In fact, my biggest worry sometime when I wrote this book is that people were going to criticize me for how much I was talking about the negativity in Eastern Europe rather than the positive things.
I want to thank Maria for her call. And actually, speaking about Hungary, here's Peter, who says the Hungarian language is part of the Finn-Ugor group, consists of Hungarian, Finnish, and Estonian. Attila the Hun had two sons, Finn and Ugor. When they arrived in the Carpathian Basin 1,000 or so years ago, the two brothers split the tribe. Finn took his people to today's Finland. Ugor remained in the Carpathian Basin. So, no, they are not from Mars. and here's a listener who says, what are the main things that we can learn from Eastern Europeans, and also how do they differ in their mindset from the United States? Now, these are big questions again, but, you know, your subtitle says what we can learn from them.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a tenacity that you see in Eastern Europe, a very strength and a toughness of being able to put up with discomfort and not complaining so much about it. I find that Americans in general, we have a tendency to complain about really small things, and I think that they're better at overcoming these things. Another thing that's interesting about Eastern Europe is that they have a flat tax system by far. You know, almost all the countries have adopted it. And here we are in the United States having a Byzantine tax code that's very complicated to understand. And because communism kind of allowed them to revamp everything, in some ways their economics, their tax system is much easier to understand than ours. For example, I didn't meet an Estonian who took more than 5 minutes to do their taxes. And the other thing is that it's fascinating that they just generally tend to be less stressed. You know, Russians actually 1 in 10 were stressed the previous day when Gallup asked them, which was the lowest rate in Europe. And I think in general they tend to have a more relaxed attitude about a lot of things than, let's say, Americans who are actually pretty stressed out.
Here's Ruth, who writes, I spent some time in Eastern Europe last year, and it is a hopeless place. The Soviets moved the farmers to the cities to work factories, which are now all closed, leaving high unemployment, and the people have forgotten how to farm. They have a saying there, the communists ruled for 47 years and it will take 47 years to recover. And another, Moses wandered for 40 years in the desert to teach the people how to be free. We are no different. In Serbia, the hopelessness comes from the fact that throughout the history of Serbia, they were at the crossroads of the conquerors, Greece, the Romans, Ottomans, Hungarians, and Russians. It has nothing. No coast, no shipping, no tourism. Croatia got everything when Yugoslavia broke up, and during the last war, the Serb refugees all ended up in Belgrade, bringing with them poverty and unemployment. Even the locals call them primitives.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the Serbians have been dealt a tough blow. They lost four wars in over an eight-year period, and so for them that has an impact on their psyche. And at the same time, you know, the Serbs are a strong people, and I think that they will pull themselves together. Right now, they're making their best efforts to get into the EU. They, you know, they've made some efforts to cooperate with the international community, and I give them kudos for that. But it is an uphill battle, and it's very frustrating to having been being a Serbian right now is still difficult because of the fact that you've had this baggage of having lost all these wars and having the international community against you. And it's a very frustrating position for them to be in.
Here's a listener named Kelly. He says, I was born and raised in Czechoslovakia, moved to San Francisco 5 years ago. Francis, I was just wondering if there was a reason why Slovakia was skipped from your journey. Well, it's not. It's here.
That's right.
Yeah. Says it's kind of sad to hear that Slovakia is usually left out, and I think there has to be a reason for that, or at least there should be. But it's not left out of your book. So.
Not at all. No, I have 25 chapters, 25 countries, and Slovakia is definitely one of them. And I absolutely adored the backpacking in Slovakia. If you go to Tatras, it's absolutely wonderful. And if you go to Bratislava, it's a beautiful, pristine capital, as well as going to the east in Košice, which is all the way in the east. It's another delightful capital. Not capital, but city.
And we go to Paul. Paul, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Yes, thank you. I've traveled twice to Bulgaria on long-distance bike rides and some bicycling travel trips. And what I see is that in Bulgaria, they're still struggling to get out of the communist era. I think the central part of the country seems to be doing better than the capital city of Sofia. But I have found the people to be very friendly, and it's very easy to cycle with all of the mountainous areas and in the southern part near Greece and the central part of the country.
Yeah, I actually had a pleasure of backpacking, I think it was April, in the Rodopi Mountains, which are down in the southwest corner of Bulgaria, southern part of Bulgaria. And you're right, it's the beauty of the scenery is great. And the caller is also right about the fact that Bulgaria is also struggling. Here's the thing, Michael, is that they had this difficult period where they kind of climbed quickly up out of communism, and then their economies are very sensitive, and they came crashing down pretty when the Great Recession hit in 2008, and that's really impacted them. And they're trying to get used to the cycle that was a little bit more muted under communism.
I think the caller listener says, I've wanted to travel to Eastern Europe. However, the anti-gay sentiment scares me, especially in Slovenia. Does the host have any comments on that? Well, you do write about homophobia.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the fact of the matter is that the homophobia is still quite large in Eastern Europe. And if you look at it, for example, in a Gallup poll, they asked people, is Eastern Europe a good place for gays and lesbians to live? And by far and away, you had 16 Eastern European countries who were less accepting than Afghanistan. Think about that. And so, you know, the Iron Curtain has become the gay curtain.
There it is. I mean, I think you can understand why gays are hesitant
for example,
to travel there.
Yeah, I mean, you have in Moscow, you have, you know, gay pride marches. You have them in Belgrade, and there's more people beating them up than people out there supporting them. It is certainly something that it's changing. It's slowly. If you look at Zagreb in Croatia, they've had some gay pride marches, and you have it also. There's more accepting in Poland and Hungary, but in general, the tolerance level, especially in the further out east, is pretty minimal.
Listener writes, I've traveled a few Eastern European countries, too, have a few similar observations. I found the Bulgarians to be extremely friendly and warm, not just with strangers, but also with each other. There's a remarkable sense of familiarity and comfort in how they approach and communicate with each other. As a brown-skinned man, I did elicit some interest in rural areas, but it was always a polite curiosity. Occasionally, I would run into someone who, upon learning that I'm from India, would either burst out into a Hindi film song or tell me about the films they've watched.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is Eastern Europeans are not used to seeing people of darker skin running around their country. In fact, I ran into one guy who was from Nigeria in Belarus, and he says 1 or 2 hours wouldn't go by before, you know, a cop would try to basically shake him down. And one time he had to go to the police station for 5 hours. But that's Belarus. Belarus is an extreme example. In general, the
extreme example of racial profiling.
That's right. But in this case, the writer is right from India. You know, at the worst, you're going to get stares, and you're going to have people who look at you and that kind of stuff, just because you're different. You know, they're just like if you're an American who goes to Tibet.
It used to be that way for Americans going to China.
Absolutely.
Right after it opened up.
That's right.
It still is in rural and outpost areas of China. Albert in Woodacre writes, my wife and I recently did a dramatic mountain biking trip in Slovenia and Croatia, including underground biking through some 400-year-old mines in Slovenia. We stayed at organic farms and local apartments. We found the people friendly and welcoming, the food terrific, and landscapes mind-blowing. Swimming in the Adriatic Sea was one of the great magical experiences of my life.
Yeah, and that's a great point, is that, you know, right now a lot of people are looking for more budget travel because of the economy has kind of restricted our ability. And the euro, even though it's come down and it's quite severe, it's still strong against the dollar. It still makes Europe, Western Europe, expensive. And so, as that writer says, it's a bargain. You know, Eastern Europe is still a great bargain. You can see some wonderful sights there, and yet they cost much less than, let's say, France or England.
Again, Francis Tappan is with us. His book is The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. And Stephen wants to know, do vegetarian diet restrictions create food problems over there?
It does. I try whenever I can to either eat vegan or vegetarian, but in Eastern Europe, it's a pretty hopeless task for the most part. It's not impossible.
What would be the best country for it?
I would say, again, probably more like Slovenia or maybe Hungary, further out east. And I'll take that back. Also, the Balkans. The Balkans have a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, and they have great cuisine. And so because of a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, you're going to have a lot of more dining options there, even though they like the cevapcici, which is a type of, you know, sausage and heavy duty
meat.
Well,
you learned a lot about the cuisine there, didn't you? There's a lot in your book. Here's Vanessa says, looking at the future, if the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, Lithuania asked you what they should do to restore the people's confidence in the democratic transition and the market economy, what would you tell them? Do you believe that the transition to a democratic regime can take place without widespread support from the grassroots level?
That's difficult. I mean, you do need the grassroots level to be there, but I think it is there. I think most Eastern Europeans do want to go more to a democratic society. It's just that there's some built-in difficulties in the infrastructure and the way that the culture is, it's slow to get there. But you got to remember also, democracy didn't come overnight in America either. It took some time and evolution. And I think that's the same thing that's going to happen in Eastern Europe.
And Paul writes, I think Reagan made some huge mistakes with the collapse of the Soviet Union. One of the biggest was the insistence on shock therapy. Instead of using the industries they had as transitioning them, Reagan practically forced them to destroy what they had, which helped the Russian mafia and chaos take over. You have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do talk about that in my book, and I'm not so sure that shock therapy. Yes, a lot of people criticize it, and like Paul is correct on that, that a lot of people criticize it. But the question is, what's the alternative? And if you look at Eastern Europe,
and remember that shock therapy was under Yeltsin too.
That's right. That's right. Yeah,
as a better manager or whatever.
That's right. And the bottom line is what was the alternative? What other way? And if you look at Eastern European countries, they tried all sorts of different ways to transition away from communism. And in all the cases, they had problems and difficulties making that transition. And so I'm not so sure shock therapy was necessarily the best way, but it's not necessarily the worst way either. I think that I understand his point, but I think that Yeltsin's biggest error was the fact that he screwed up the privatization process so much and giving the oligarchs so much power. And that was the biggest flaw that still
haunts them. Yeah.
Yes, it still plagues them today.
David, you're on with us. Hi.
Great. Hey, I'm a landscape photographer. Are there any opportunities for teaching English over there?
Yeah, they love English speakers. And so you pretty much – you can go almost anywhere there. And they're in desperate need for English speakers almost everywhere.
Thank you for that question and call. And Bill, you're next. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I traveled to 40 countries in the 60s, never staying in a hotel or eating in a restaurant, and that was about how Francis did it. And I was never threatened. In fact, people were nicer to me in general all over those 40 countries. And so isn't it true that unless you're in conflict with somebody over something, that the no group of people are hostile to another group unless their managers want to enhance their status? I even blame Moses because he goes into Canaan and he exaggerates what the Canaanites are doing in order to make his people hate them. And Homer, he says that honor is a great thing, and glorious Hercules fights glorious Hector with golden helmets. If these guys would have just minded their own business, I don't think we would have any of the kind of problems we have.
All right. There's an opinion to reckon with. Miles says, your guest has a life story to be jealous of. Does he have any suggestions for someone trying to follow a similar path?
Yeah, I mean, I think that learning how to be happy with little and learning not to – we have a tendency that once your income rises, we raise our expenses as well. And so I think that one of the tricks is to learn not to raise your standard of living the moment it becomes possible to do so. And that what that does is it allows you to accumulate savings, which then gives you a lot of financial flexibility in order to do different things. And so that's the step one.
Well, the next step for you – you want to go to Africa and do all 55 countries?
That's right. So I want to visit every single country in Africa. It's a three-year project. It's two things that I need to do in between now and then is, number one, I need to...
brush up on your Swahili.
That's right. No, basically, I'm looking for potentially having a video production company or a cable network to make a show out of it, potentially. And the second thing is a partner to travel with throughout that region. That will be fun.
What do you do about, like, before you go in terms of preparation for languages? And the like?
Yeah, I do try to learn the languages whatever language, even if it's a language like Estonian or Latvian, which is very few people actually speak, because I think it's polite to just know how to say thank you and so and hello and just the basic stuff. The longer I spend there, like when I spent in the Russian-speaking countries, I had to learn Russian because very few people knew how to speak otherwise. So it was kind of forced. But I enjoy learning languages.
Говорите ли вы по-русски?
Я говорю по-русски.
Очень хорошо.
Спасибо большое.
Good to have you here.
Спасибо.
Thank you for being with us. This is Francis Tappan, and again, his book, The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And remind you, you can always let us know what you think about Forum or what you hear on Forum or what you'd like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page and join our Facebook page. There's a lot to learn about Forum on it. You can also call us at 415-553-3300. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Amy Machado, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.